This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Trainer Todd Pletcher has reached the stratosphere.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Moon over Miami for Bill Mott.
3,000 for trainer Mark Cassie.
Trainer D-Way Lucas, a 6th win.
And Bob Baffert with another incredible milestone.
But it was all for Chuck McGee.
Win number 1,000 for the great Trevor McCarthy.
Here's 2,000 for Nick Zito.
Steve Aspison is now North America's all-time leading trainer.
Now here's Mike Pena.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show Trainers Listen To. It is Trainer Talk, and as always, it is presented by our friends at Fasig Tipton, and it's right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Pena, Baron of the Backstretch, happy to have you along for the ride for the next hour on Sirius 162, XM 207, streaming worldwide at horseracingradio.net and podcast on major podcast platforms each and every week. Well, today's guest has been successful in a multitude of industry facets, from working as a highly respected equine dentist to purchasing a Kentucky Derby starter at public auction to handicapping and to training. He could be considered your one-stop shop for all things horse racing. And today, I am extremely fortunate that he has taken time to stop by Trainer Talk for the next hour to tell his story, especially considering his busy week as he prepares to saddle his 2-year-old gelding One Red Scent in Saturday's Grade 2 Kentucky Jockey Club at Churchill Downs. Please join me in welcoming trainer John Jezuski to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. John, appreciate the visit.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I really do appreciate it. And I think I may have even gotten your name wrong there. Jezuski, yeah. The proper pronunciation,
there
correct?
There you go. There you go. Yep,
yeah,
correct.
And you warned me before we started the conversation. You said, just don't look at it.
Yep. Yeah, we always know when we go out to eat and someone, they're stuttering and they're, you know, him-hawing around, and it's like, oh, that's probably us because they can't say the name. Yeah, to call our table. But, yeah.
Well, I really do appreciate it. My apologies. Yeah, sure. Hey, listen, John, is there anything that you haven't done in this sport?
You know, we've done everything we can to be successful, which changes in this business. You have to be adaptable and do whatever it takes. And it's went down different roads that we probably thought we would never take. But we've been fortunate and we've had a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned the handicapping side of things, and we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the purchase of your Kentucky Derby starter that was Far Right, who was knocking heads with American Pharoah that year. You didn't come along in an easy year there, but you did purchase Far Right, and he makes it to the Kentucky Derby. You purchased him for, what, $2,500? We're going to talk about that story. We're going to talk about what you're doing now on the training side of things. But let's start from the beginning. Where did this journey and this love of horse racing begin for you?
Well, I grew up in Wisconsin, and everybody thinks that is dairyland and the cheese state, but as most people know, there's a lot of good horsemen came out of there. Of course, the legendary Dwayne Lucas was the main one, as well as the Rices and the Helmbrechts, and even one of the best race callers of all time, Tom Durkin. And so those were all way before my time. But I got to see how much success they had coming from that small bush track to the successes they had, and I just fell in love with it there.
What part of Wisconsin?
We were in Wautoma, right in central Wisconsin.
Okay.
Like the rest of the, like Dwayne and all of them were from up in Anago, north of there. We just traveled that summer meet, you know, and went to the races.
Yeah, I had a good friend of mine that is from La Crosse, Wisconsin, and he would always he'd be very proud of the fact that Wayne Lucas coached basketball in La Crosse. And of course, Wayne noted for his skills in coaching basketball, but La Crosse was a spot that he spent some time, and I remember my buddy would always brag about that. Not so much the horse trainer, but the fact that he coached basketball in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Right, the relationships beyond that, yes, exactly.
Yep. So, okay, so you grow up in Wisconsin. How were you first introduced to horse racing?
So my parents, they trained and raced in the bush track, you know, during the summers. And, of course, like every kid that age, when I was following it, I wanted to be a jockey. You didn't dream of being a trainer. You wanted to be a jockey in the action, you know. And they would have, so when they'd have the meet, they'd have, like, pony races before, one pony race beforehand. And it wasn't like a typical, like, oh, the kids get on a pony and they finish. It was pretty competitive because those little boys bet on it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I would always stand where they're starting, and they did Holly Gully, not from the gate with them. And they were rearing up, spinning around. Anyway, this pony dropped this kid twice. And the second time they dropped him, he shook his head and said he wouldn't go on. So I said, I ducked up underneath the rail, and I went and told the guy, I said, I'll ride this horse. I'll ride this pony. Anyway, long story short, I won by many, and that adrenaline just filled me, and it was game over from there. That was like the next. That was like I couldn't. I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Wow. So. Did you pursue that career path at one point?
You know, of course, I'm 200 pounds now, so you know where that went eventually. But I actually was. We were pretty successful. I started at 11. Talked my parents into let me start at 11. I just rode our horses, won quite a few races. At 12, they made me carry 28 pounds of lead, which is hard to believe at this point in life. But, yeah, I carried 28 pounds of lead, and we won a lot of races. I ended up, when I was 15, I was the leading rider at that meet. And so that, you know, but knowing that, I mean, I loved it, lived it, loved it, but I knew I could only do it for so long.
Yeah. Yeah. So what age did you finally decide, okay, enough's enough. I'm not going to make a living doing this. I need to do something else.
Yeah, I was 17. I was already getting too heavy. And so then I thought, well, the next thing I was going to be is a trainer, you know. And so and being on the bush track and stuff, everybody wants to go to the big track. That's all you talked about, going to the big track, you know. And the closest thing to us was Canterbury, you know. So once I graduated, I went there and galloped, and that's kind of got my feet wet in being on the racetrack, and started there.
Did you start to get the itch to ride again when you were galloping?
Oh, I loved it. And, of course, I was so – even when I was galloping at Canterbury, I was so heavy, I got the worst horses. You know, I got the quarter horses that would blow the turn. I would get the horses that would be, you know, come out of their bucket. And so – but I still loved it. And then I went from there, I went down to Florida, and I broke babies. You know, I did that kind of that typical tour that everybody does, you know. And then I bought two cheap horses, bought a pair of horses for $2,500 for Tampa, took them back up to Canterbury, and that's where I got my license, my trainer's license.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Talk about breaking babies, because that's a topic we don't often get into here on Trainer Talk, because, you know, a lot of trainers have not done that throughout their career. So tell me about those days and what that was like, and some of the things that maybe you learned doing that even help you today.
Oh, it was huge. You learn a lot about horses when you start them. I enjoyed that. I still enjoy that part. Developing babies. And like I said, that's why we had a lot of success Pinhook, and also, you know, because those babies have to be ready early on, and that's no easy task, you know. And you, both mentally and physically, you got to get them there, and I enjoy it. I enjoy it. And I was surrounded with people that were good at it and fortunately learned a lot, you know.
Mm-hmm. I referenced that on Saturday you're going to saddle One Red Scent in the Grade 2 Kentucky Jockey Club Stakes at Churchill Downs. Has that experience that you gained in breaking the babies and working with those young horses before they get to the races, has that helped you when you start working with young two-year-olds like this?
Definitely, definitely. But I would say the biggest turning point was when we had Far Right that went to the Derby.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you get around a good horse like that, you learn a lot. I mean, that, and then you have a reference. With everything you do, you can kind of go back to that and use that reference to you know, in the future, you know. And I would say that was the biggest turning point, was having him. Because, I mean, we knew he was real from as soon as we got him. And then I sent him down to Florida, and Tony Costanzo, a friend of mine, he gets him ready, and he told me, he said, as soon as he got there, he's like, this is the kind of horse you need to buy. And, you know, this business, you can't get too cocky or too arrogant about it, but I told my wife and kids, I said, buy your Derby hats. I think we're going to the Derby.
Wow.
Yeah, because he was kind of a freak, you know. He was talented.
Yeah, you purchased him from the Darby Dan consignment, and I referenced earlier in the show, for the purchase price of $2,500. That's $2,500, not $2.5 million, as we typically think about, you know, public auctions and racing. So $2,500. What was it that led you to make that purchase? What'd you see in him?
Well, actually, there's where the dental work comes into play. Like, I was doing quite a few horses. Like right now, I do 100 head a week. So I see a lot of horses and a lot of good horses. Like this year, I did the Derby horse as a yearling and National Treasure as a yearling. So when you're seeing all these horses, you get a kind of a mental picture of what they need to look like. And I can never afford a pedigree, and so I would just go after that physical look. And he looked like a chiseled athlete when he was that short yearling. And so, and his attitude. I mean, he had that, and they have to have that attitude too. And so it was the fact that he looked like a chiseled athlete. He had the attitude, and that's kind of what I went after.
Yeah, Far Right, for folks that aren't familiar with his name, Far Right ran in the 2015 Kentucky Derby, which was won by eventual Triple Crown winner American Pharoah. Prior to that, he was second to American Pharoah in the Arkansas Derby. He won the Southwest Stakes. He was a really top-notch 3-year-old early on in the season, and he went on to win 4 of 25 starts. He earned $767,000. How's that for a return on investment for a $2,500 purchase? You know, John, I hear these stories, and I think, boy, the sport of kings, come on, give me a break. Anybody in this game can compete with anybody else. You just have to have a little luck.
It is. And I've been told that my whole life how lucky I am. And that's the truth. They can come from obscure pedigrees and you know, and you can be successful in this game at any level. So we do appreciate that part of it.
Mm-hmm. It's incredible to me that you were so confident in this horse in the beginning, even though he was, again, I'll say it again, a $2,500 yearling. But you were so confident. You said, "Hey, go get the Derby hats. This horse is going to take us there." And it doesn't often work out like that. I mean, it's such a long shot to get a horse to the Kentucky Derby, but it's nice to be, no pun intended, it's nice to be right once in a while, isn't it?
Right. That when they interviewed me, that's what I said. I said, the money comes and goes, but you just want to be right, you know? And I enjoyed the fact that he was that successful, you know? And the thing is, you know, he ran second his first two starts, and I was devastated. I was like, how did this horse just run second? Well, you know, in those maiden races, the first horse that beat him went on to be Conquest Tsunami, who made, I think, $1 million. Mm-hmm. And the second horse that beat him was Ashmi. Said, I went to Churchill, and they said, you can't beat this horse. And I was thinking, yeah, I can beat this horse. And we ran second to Cinco Charlie, you know. And so, yeah. So that's kind of the, what then, and then the phone started ringing to buy him, because then everybody knew what he was, you know. So,
yeah, talking with trainer John Jezeski here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. If you're just tuning in, he's kind of done it all throughout his career. We're walking through his background now, but, you know, talking about that purchase as a bloodstock agent, you know, listen, here was a quote that I found as I was getting ready for the program. It was in an article that was written by Frank Angst in the Blood Horse in 2015 before the Kentucky Derby. And your quote was, I was just joking with some friends that if you pay $1 million for a horse, there's a line of people waiting to shake your hand. But if you pay $2,500, you're lucky to get a handshake from the consigner. And then you went on to say, the thing is, though, at that point, no one knows how either of those horses is going to turn out. And isn't that the beauty of this game at the very core?
Oh, my goodness. I said it's a weird feeling when you're at the sale and you are the only – I've been the only bidder several times. When you are the only person in that whole pavilion, in that sales ground, that's willing to raise your hand for that individual, there's a little bit of insecurity that takes place at that moment, you know. And you don't actually know what you have until you get them home. But yeah, it's just part of it, you know. When we pinhooked, we bought one for $10,000, and she went 9-4. We sold it for $230,000. And the next year, everybody thought I was just going to go and pour it all back in, and I just couldn't bring myself to do it. You know, I mean, I've never spent over $15,000 on one, and we've had plenty of success at that lower level.
Yep. Yeah, you don't have to spend $1 million on a horse to be successful in this game. As a matter of fact, I would argue that the majority of horses that we see succeeding are not those $1, $2, $3 million horses.
Yes. And I enjoy that part. I enjoy taking that underdog and beating the big dogs. I mean, it's just part of it that you can really appreciate.
Was the Kentucky Derby experience everything you thought it would be?
It was excellent because Harry Rosenblum, who bought him from me, he treated us like we still owned him. And he went up with Robert LaPenta and their box upstairs. He gave us his tickets, and we were treated like owners. So we were down right there on the rail, own betting window, own everything was – and the walk over – is everything everybody says it is. It was just like we still owned them. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
And it'll spoil you because you probably won't go to the Derby again until you get in that position. But yeah, it was wonderful.
Yeah, and I love Ron Moquette. I love his story. I think he's a tremendous horseman. And to have him by your side through this whole journey was fantastic too, wasn't it?
You know what? There again, I could talk to him anytime, and he treated me just like I was part of it too. No, he's great. He's a great horseman, great person.
Yep, it was a great ride. John, tell me more about the dentist side of things. Where did that come along in your career?
That came from thinking I was going to be a trainer and you know, living on crackers and water with ketchup, or you know, like whatever you could get at the racetrack. I was training out in California, and you know, it's expensive out there. Had no money, and one of the riders was complaining my horse was blowing the turn, and I called the dentist, and he was like 3 weeks that you had to wait for him to come. And so I was like, God, this guy's busy. And he came and did like 3 horses in 45 minutes, and he was charging $80 a head. And I was like, oh, my goodness, this is something to get into, you know. So I went to school out there, and I apprenticed under him. And he said, I'll let you apprentice as long as you leave, you know, and because you didn't want the competition. And of course, we moved straight to Kentucky, you know, the land of opportunity. And it all just kind of it blossomed. We, my wife and I celebrated when I did 3 in a day. You know, we thought that was a big deal. And now I do 100 head a week. So
wow.
Yeah.
How do you find time to do that? Because that's about 14 a day on average. How do you do it?
Yeah. No, I mean it's just a typical schedule. Like my wife, she's an attorney, so. We get up in the morning. She gets up earlier than I do, like 4 something, and we go to the track at 5. She does the stall mucking, I do the hot walking and watching them train, and then we come back home, feed our horses at the farm, and then 8:30 she goes off to work. I go off to work, and I do half days. I'll do from 8:30 to 1, and then I'll do another group later. And we kind of manage it that way. And there again, it just took on a life of its own. I do like 700 or 800 yearlings a year, so I get to see a lot of horses that people don't. You know, same thing with the broodmares. I'm seeing all the babies before everybody else because I see these babies by their side. You know, and that part has really helped as far as getting that eye to see the ones that'll probably come be talented. You know.
Has that ever led you to acquiring a horse to train where you're working with the horse's teeth and somebody says, hey, you know, we're looking at selling this horse. Are you interested?
Oh, my gosh. So, Spendthrift. Got to love Spendthrift. I mean, they've given us, of course, Far Right was by Notional. One Red Sense by Dominus. We got that stud for free. Anyway, I was working at Spendthrift, and the assistant broodmare manager said, we have all these Hampton Courts. He's going back to Australia. Nobody's really, you know, he's not a really marketable horse. He said, why don't you come over and pick one out? You can pick one out for $1,000. And there was like six of them. He said, I'll pick out the best two pedigrees. So anyway, he picks up, or he shows me the two. I take the filly, so she had residual value. Long story short with her, she wins first time out at Churchill, and we sell her for $200,000. That was well spent. And she went on to make $300,000. So that was a great story.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Yep. I love it. And now here's One Red Scent, a 2-year-old gelded son of Dominus, who is going to try and take down a grade two on Saturday after breaking his maiden in a maiden claiming race, albeit a $100,000 maiden claiming race on November 15th. But, you know, this is a horse that can run a little bit.
You know, there again, like having far right, I compare everything to him. This horse he's gifted. He's a talented horse. He's had hard luck. Like, if you watch his races, I mean, the trouble he's been in, the traffic, mud in his face, I mean, every race, and he still showed up, you know. So we kind of, you know, thought he's pretty special, but, of course, we went into that race 0-6, and that'll humble you, you know.
Yeah.
But when we put him in for 30, I was hoping, like, heck, nobody would take him, you know, because I kind of didn't want to lose him, you know, and they claimed two or three out of there. And then we had him in for 50, and we were on the also eligible, and I could have drew in, and I opted for the 100 so we'd get the same jock back on him. And we were confident. I mean, we thought we'd win, and it was kind of a plan, almost like a paid breeze 10 days out, you know. I mean, it was kind of all plan, you hate to say it because you know how it can backfire, but it kind of worked out just as we planned.
Yeah, incredible. And now here he is taking a big step up. What is it that gives you the confidence, John, that he can compete at this grade two level?
Well, there again, like, so I'm there early. He trains in the dark. You can see where this horse is all the way around her. He's got such a beautiful way of moving. And they're all going by you, and you can hear them all going. This horse floats across ground so easy, you can't even hear him go by you. He's so efficient, I think. We always thought he'd go long. It just so happened he had that natural speed, and that showed up those last two races, you know. But I don't think he has to have that lead. I think he could sit off it, you know, and make one move. And I think he's legit. I think he's legit. I mean, you know, we're pretty realistic. Like, we take these chances, and then we backpedal. You know, he'll be back in for a tag if we get beat. You know, I mean, we're realistic that way, but we do like to take those chances.
Well, another Wisconsin native who we mentioned earlier, Dwayne Lucas, has made a living of taking shots in big races. And I remember visiting with him on this very same show years ago when we were at Saratoga. And he talked about that and his philosophy that, hey, you can't win it if you're not in it, right? And you have to take those shots occasionally.
Exactly. I just used that comment when someone else was calling me, saw that he was in. I said, you can't win if you're not in it. Yep. And anything can happen in a horse race. So yeah, you definitely want to. And we're fortunate to have good connections, like Corrales. You know, it's hard for me to get a good jack just being a small stable, you know. And now the fact that he's going to be on for the third time, he knows him well. And that's going to help a lot, you know. That'll help give us an opportunity. And then at the end of the day, we just see how much talent we actually have when you're running against those kind of horses.
If you look back at the Kentucky Jockey Club and the history of that race, and you look at the trainers who have been in the winner's circle after that race, you see names like Hall of Famers, Lucas, Mott, Baffert, Zito, Asmussen, Cassie, Pletcher, Jezeski. What do you think?
Actually, I love that part of it because I respect all those guys, and I know their records and what they've accomplished. And so if I have a good horse, like I've had in the past, I almost love being in those scenarios. I don't want to beat nobody. If I can beat the best that exists and the best in the game, that to me is satisfaction.
Yep. Yeah, and it's vindication that you belong too, right?
Right, exactly. there again, like people, they don't give you any respect. Me, I never got any respect. My wife's like, why do you have that chip on your shoulder? I don't pay anything for horses. Therefore, people just think you're lucky, not that you're good. They just think lucky. Because if you paid, now if I would have paid $60,000, $100,000 for Far Right, they would have been, oh my gosh, this guy's a brilliant bloodstock agent. But the fact that I paid $2,500, I'm just lucky, you know. And so you just love to be in that atmosphere with those, that caliber of trainer and have success.
Yeah, exactly. I think every athlete in every sport, and I think it holds true for trainers and for jockeys, I think it's very much, you know, what have you done for me lately? And you can fall out of favor very quickly, especially in this day and age where satisfaction, everybody wants that instant satisfaction, right? So you're always, no matter who you are, you're always trying to continually prove yourself again and again and again.
Yes. I mean, Dwayne's a good example. You know, like, he was on top of the game, and he had some quiet years. And then he climbed right back and was on top again, you know. Everybody knows it's an up and down business, you know. And you just got to keep. And that's why, like, I like going to Keeneland, even watching the races, because your eye needs to see the best of the best. And if you can't just have it in your mind what that horse is supposed to look like, you know, you get a little jaded. You got to keep looking and looking, and it changes, and you got to adapt to the changes, you know.
John, how do you describe your training philosophy and your approach to getting these horses ready?
I have one of the best people I've ever come across, Concepcion Torres. And he's been with me for a long time. We've had a lot of success together. Since I can't do it myself, I'm so fortunate to have him. That's probably one of the best people on and off the horse. And so that part is good. And another thing is, you know, since we're not a commercial trainer, we don't need to go by the book. We don't need every Saturday to lay him on the wood, you know. I mean, if we want to skip a breeze, if we want a two-minute lick, we're big into two-minute licking instead of breezing. If we want to run them back in 10 days and because they're popping out of their skin and we think they came back good from the race, we do it. And I think that's allowed us to have some success, you know, some hidden success.
You talk about the term that you just used, two-minute lick. There could be people listening to this show that aren't in the know when it comes to training horses. So explain what that is and why it's different from breezing.
So you're going at a two-minute mile. Whether it doesn't matter what distance you're going, if it's a half, five-eighths, or whatever, as long as you're going at that speed the whole way around, it gets air in them, but you're not abusing them. You're not pounding on their joints and everything. And so we've had a ton of success getting them to the races and then only having a few, you know, few breezes and winning first time out, you know, and winning, you know, right off the bat with younger babies and stuff, especially babies.
Yeah. Fantastic stuff. John Jezeski, my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. John, stay with me. We've got to get to a short commercial break. When we come back, we'll continue to talk more about your career and your journey and some of the horses that you're never going to forget. We'll do that in the second half of Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Don't miss Fasig Tipton's upcoming Mid-Atlantic December Mixed and Horses of Racing Age Sale. Offering weanlings, broodmares, racing and broodmare prospects, and a large supplement of horses of racing age. It is a proven venue to restock your breeding operation or racing stable before the end of the year. The Fasig Tipton Mid-Atlantic December Mixed and Horses of Racing Age Sale, Tuesday, December 5th in Timonium, Maryland. Where will you be?
There are plenty of thrills at Gulfstream Park with live thoroughbred action Friday through Sunday and simulcasting 7 days a week. Join us on track for weekend stakes races and make plans for opening day of the championship meet on Friday, December 1st. Dine trackside in 10 ponds with an elevated view of the track and grab a cool cocktail in the Carousel Club. For reservations, tickets, and more, head to GulfstreamPark.com.
Well, Fasig's family, basically. Some of the guys that work here I've known for 30 years. I just felt really supported, and they're great communicators. They try to help in whatever you do.
Phasic Tipton's has a sale for every market, every segment in the industry. There's multiple opportunities where you're going to have plenty of good buying and selling situations.
Great customer service. I'm not only a buyer with them, but I'm a seller, and I've always been well taken care of.
There's a lot of different things that sometimes you need at a sale, and Phasic Tipton is there every step of the way.
They show year after year that they're ethical and they're fair, and they enjoy what they do. But when you're around people that have a combination of all those things, you know, you can't lose.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And the truth or else on the far outside is coming after them now. Mr. Z is under pressure, passed by Hillbilly Royalty. They're joined by the truth or else as they head for home. Hillbilly Royalty narrowly. Mr. Z is fighting back. On the outside of them, the truth or else. And far right is finding his best stride at the rail. Mr. Z, tenacious. Far right is closing stoutly. And the truth or else. Far right has the momentum. And far right takes the lead close to home. Far right and Mike Smith winning the Southwest. Photo for second, Mr. Z and the truth or else. Bold Conquest found his best stride late to finish fourth.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This, of course, is where racing comes to talk, and talking with trainer John Jezeski, the man who selected and picked out Far Right, the Grade 3 Southwest Stakes winner in 2015 before going to the Kentucky Derby that year. Unfortunately, he came along in the same year as American Pharoah, but boy, that doesn't take anything away from what he accomplished on the racetrack, and we talked about Far Right in the first half of the program. Frank Miramati had the call of that Southwest Stakes that you just heard. If you missed any portion of the first half of the show, you know what to do. Head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can listen to the podcast whenever you get some time, and you can do that on every podcast platform, not just this show, but all of the shows we bring your way each and every week throughout the year. Check them out on Apple Podcasts and Podbean and Spotify. However you access your podcast, type in Horse Racing Radio Network and take us along with you wherever you go. Well, John, I had to take you on a little trip down memory lane to begin the second half of the program. We talked a lot about Far Right in the first half of the show, but that moment, watching him win the Grade 3 Southwest, had to be really special for you.
Oh my gosh. So sitting there with my family, we're screaming, jumping up and down, you know, like anybody would do. And actually what was funny is when he got beat by American Pharoah, my daughter, she kept saying, man, that horse is gorgeous. That horse is talented. And all of a sudden, he wins, like, it just annihilates everybody. And she's like, oh, my gosh, that horse is special. And I lectured her, like, I said, don't talk. I said, what are you talking about? I just lectured her. I was like, what are you talking about? He just beat Far Right. But she was absolutely right, because of course he went on to be who he was, you know. But it was hard to swallow, hard to watch that defeat, you know, since he was doing so well.
Yeah, I think he won the Arkansas Derby by 8, and of course, as I mentioned, yeah, Far Right was second. But listen, if you're going to be second to anybody, let it be a Triple Crown winner, right?
Exactly. Like that's like the best thing you could say about him is, you know, he went on to make 700,000, he went second to Triple Crown winner, you know, so. Yeah, it was like I said, that whole scenario was so remarkable. It was a fun road from beginning to end too. Yeah.
Yep, incredible. But before we got to the commercial break in the first half of the program, you had mentioned your wife Patience and her role in helping you, and then going to work, working as an attorney, and then coming back and helping with the horses later in the day, whatever the case might be. But it's incredible how many times I've had a trainer come on this show over the years and they talk about their wife and the contributions that they make to their program and making them successful. And I'm sure looking at some of the ownership partnerships that you put together, Patience is right there. She's an integral part of your success. So talk a little bit more about that. Was it a racetrack romance? Is that how you met?
Well, high school sweethearts. Which that's a rare thing now too, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, she went on to college. I went on to the racetrack thinking I was going to be rich and successful. And then we both moved to Kentucky, and she went out, she was in law school. I got the dental business started. And then we were in breeding and buying and stuff together, as just basically a hobby. And everybody that knows both of us knows I would be nowhere without her. Yeah, she's
yep.
my.
You know, her name is so perfect too. If you're involved in the horse business, the number one thing you have to learn is patience. So I think she has the right name to be involved in this sport.
Oh my gosh. And I don't, I mean, the one I married is the only patience I have. And so and even those babies and stuff, like I want ready quick. She's slowed me down and, you know, made it so I wasn't quite as gung ho, pushing. And anybody in the horse business knows that that's a very important aspect of it.
Are you like that with the dental side of your business too?
Not at all. As much as I am, my wife says I'm an adrenaline junkie, which growing up riding races and stuff, you kind of become that and doing all the sports and everything. But you have to turn that off when you're dealing with horses, because I don't sedate really any of them other than yearlings and pulling wolf teeth on. So you have to turn that off. So they're calm and relaxed, and you can get the job done that's in front of you. Yeah. It's a whole different aspect of
two different mindsets, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I mean, they know it. They know it. I had a filly that was in a grade one winning year in up Canada, Cold Hearted Pearl, her name was. And I went to a farm that I've been doing for years, probably 20 years. And, I never have anything sedated. All the broodmares were snorting and lost their mind. And he's like, "John, what on earth is going on?" I said, "They must feel it." I said, I can't come today. I said, "I got this filly in this grade one. I'm nervous as heck. They feel it." I said, "I can't work today." So that kind of was a reality check on how you got to turn it off when you're dealing directly with the horses like that.
You also spend a lot of time and you give a lot of thought to naming your own horses. So tell me more about that.
Oh, I love that part of it. So like Cold Hearted Pearl, she was, I knew the guy that had her early on. She was born outside. It was 8 degrees. And she was born on my sister-in-law's birthday, Pearl. And so we just named her Cold Hearted Pearl. And everybody got a kick out of that. When I'd enter, the guy's like, "Oh, I used to know a girl like that." He thought I said Cold Hearted Girl. He said, "I used to know a girl like that." And I'm like, "Oh, it's Cold Hearted Pearl," you know? And then I like to be creative. My wife has to stop me from being tacky sometimes. But one of the most interesting ones is the latest, One Red Cent. So he was born during COVID. We couldn't go to the races. And a buddy of mine, Mark Dyser, that's listed as an owner there, we go to the races together. We couldn't go, so I said, "Why don't you come over to my house? I have a live feed. We'll watch it on the big screen. Bring over some beer, and we'll, you know, bet and watch races." And he always said, "Hey, if everyone's foaling, I want to watch it. I want to, you know, call me any time of day, any time of day or night. Well, as he drives up, the mare's foaling outside. And I'm like, "Oh, my gosh." I said, "What timing?" I said, "This is your chance, you know." He said, "Can I help?" I said, "Well, let her get far enough along." And I said, yeah, that's fine. So anyway, the big rangy foal, and he helped foal it out. And I said, "Well, I'll give you 5%, you know, like foaling fee, like ownership." He said, "Really? Oh, that'd be great." He said, "Well, how much is he worth?" I said, "He's not worth one red cent." And he's like, "What?" I said, "He's not." I said, "It's a third generation brood mare that was modest." And I said, "I got the stud fee for free." I said, "It doesn't mean he can't run. It doesn't mean he can't run. I'm just saying he has no commercial value whatsoever, you know, until he runs." So that's, and we named him that day. We named him that day, One Red Cent.
Wow, that's a fantastic story. He'll be worth a lot more if he can win the Kentucky Jockey Club on Saturday.
Yeah, I think they'll think he's more than one red cent.
Right.
No doubt. Yeah.
Now he is a gelding, right? So that would, you know, obviously take away from any kind of stud value. But what led to that decision to geld him?
Well, like a good friend of ours that does our work, Dr. Monahay, he had a one-eyed gelding that was in on the Derby trail. And the once you get those Derby points, the money they offer is way beyond what we could dream of anyway. And so, and there again, you know, they have to be have a really good pedigree to be a stallion. Like even Far Right, he never went on to be a stud because he just had no worth, you know. So he had no worth other than racing, and he was a little difficult. I mean, it took Conception a long time to break the starts. He's very quirky. I think that's why it's taken him so many starts to break his mate. Very quirky, very hard to deal with. And now he has just gotten so, so professional. I mean, he does everything like clockwork, but man, we took us a long time to get there. So we did that early on because that we thought it'd help just getting us to the races.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm flipping through on Equibase some of the names of the horses that you have trained and owned, and sticking with this name theme for a minute and you naming your own horses. There's a filly that came across my screen here, Eye of the Beholder. Where did that name come from?
Yes. Well, there again, it was all these cheap ones we buy, and all of a sudden you're the only bidder on a horse, and you're thinking it's all about the eye of the beholder because, like, one man's junk is another man's treasure kind of thing. And I said, I was hoping she'd be successful, and she wasn't, and so that was disappointing. When you name a good, what you think is a good name, it's disappointing if they can't follow through and, you know, make something of themselves. But I just thought that was fitting. I had to behold it because that's what it is. When we're going to the sales and we're looking at these horses and when we're breeding them and everything, it's totally that.
Yeah. You know, one of my favorites is a horse that you don't own, but you did train this horse. And I say it's my favorite because I have a very, very dear friend named Scott. And I remember seeing this horse in the program, and he's not a horse player, but I said, listen, if you're ever going to play a horse, maybe this is it. And the horse's name is Zip It Scotty, which is extremely appropriate. And I thought, man, this is a fantastic name.
So there again, he had no bid at the Phasic Tipton auction. And Scott Mallory, I do his work, did his dad's work, known him for years. I tried not to go to the February sale just because my wife, she's like, don't go there because you just buy a horse because it's like a drug to me, you know. It's like an addiction. So if I go there, I'm going to buy something. So I stay away from the sale. They are an AM. I call Scott and I said, Scott, what's up with this horse? He's 3x3 Carson City, you know. He said, you know, there's nothing wrong with him. He's out of an older mare, but he said he's fine. So anyway, when we get him, we name him after Scott. And he had that city zip line being Runaway and Hyde. And so we named him Zip It Scotty. And so everybody kind of liked it. And it's funny is when, you know, he won 4 out of his 5 at Belterra, so he's cheap. But the state vet that would pull blood, her husband's name was Scott. And so she's like, oh, my God. Every time he's in, I said, you just zip it, Scotty. You just shut your mouth. So I gave her a win picture when he won, and she said, it's on the refrigerator. I remind him he needs to zip it a lot. So, yeah, that's fun stuff.
That's a great story. I'm going to ask you about one more. I have to ask you about this name, Tonic and Gin.
Oh, my goodness. That's got a little bit of sentimental and emotional value. So my mother-in-law, she passed away kind of earlier than we had anticipated. And the last thing I did on the 4th of July, we saw her, and we were out dancing on the deck to Billy Joel's Making Love to Tonic and Gin, and she was a gin drinker. And so that's how that came to be. Yeah. And then when they claimed that filly, my daughter just got married, and when they claimed that filly 2 weeks before the wedding, I was like, that must have been Nancy's intervention. She was like helping us pay for that darn wedding. <You know? laughs> we depend way too much on these horses for our lifestyle, you know, our life.
Yeah. Such a great story. Yeah, and yeah. Pulling at the emotional heartstrings there a little bit. But what a wonderful story, and what a wonderful ride it has been for my special guest here on Trainer Talk, John Jezeski. He's done an awful lot of things in this business, and as you heard us talk about earlier in the program, the pin hooking side of it has been an integral part of of his business and his success. So, John, talk a little bit more about that and how the pin hooking has kind of led to a lot of the other things you've been able to do and be successful with.
Yeah, kind of, you know, a little bit by accident. So Patience was in law school. I was trying to get my business started. We were just kind of doing that thing. And my grandmother, she gave all her grandchildren $5,000 for, like, buying a house or investing or whatever they wanted to do. She was not in the horse business, knew nothing about it. She would be totally upset if she found out I bought a horse with it. So what I did, I kind of went around that scenario a little bit. I put it in an account. I borrowed the money off it, and I bought a Trampolino filly, Phasic Tipton, for $5,000. And, you know, that's not exactly the pin-hooking type of sire. And, you know, and she turned in a little bit, you know, confirmation. Dr. DeWitt Owen was the one that inspected her. And I said, I know she turns in, but I said, I think she'll be okay. He said, don't worry. He said, that just means speed. And he was like the guru for confirmation, so I thought I was all right. Anyway, long story short, we sold her 6 months later for $37,000. Mm. And so that was like, we were broke at the time. So that was like a huge, huge deal for us. And then we went on. We did it, you know, more and more. And we'd send everything down to Tony and Peggy Costanzo. And we had one that we bought for $10,000, sold her for $230,000. She went 9-4, $230,000. And then it got to the point where, like, Ocala, they wouldn't take anything that you didn't pay $30,000 for. And then the sales weren't taking place here at Keeneland anymore, the two-year-old sales. So then we started racing and selling off of racing and kind of went that avenue. So that's how it developed into there. And I bought a horse we named the Freak. I bought him for $1,500. He was inbred to Secretary. It looked just like him. And he had a fractured sesamoid that healed. And they told me, they said, either he'll live with it or he won't. And anyway, he bullet worked at Keeneland, went in 59 and change. And we sold him for $150,000. And he ran second first time out for Dallas Stewart. And I was so disappointed. I felt bad for Dallas and everything and the connections. Well, it turned out the horse he ran second to was Dialed In.
Ooh.
So that's when the reality hits, you know, when you run second in a maiden race and whoever beats you ends up being, you know, pretty special.
So, yeah, the history of running second to these special horses. You need to pick some softer company.
Well, you know, there again, I said, it's funny because you have all these different people going to you know, breeding in Pennsylvania, breeding in Indiana. I said, we came to Kentucky to run in Kentucky. And I said, if we can't win at Churchill or Keeneland, I kind of don't want, you know, I'd rather let them go to someone else and they can have success anyway, which way they can, you know. But I love that top, you know, I love the spotlight. I love the big races and taking our chances, you know.
How many horses, I mean, there's, do you nothing have training like waiting now?
Well, they claimed two office, and we sold one of the cheap ones, so we're down to two out of the five. So we got five stalls at the training center, and we keep five stalls there. And we're down to just two, which is one red cent. And I got a filly I really like that she had some issues early on. She's getting ready. She'll probably start at Turfway, another two-year-old. And that's all we got going right now.
What's her name?
Dove at Dawn. Dove at Dawn.
Where'd she get her name?
Conception. Conception. They're Conception's partners with me on some, and his daughters, his sons were involved, you know, helping groom and all that. The daughters weren't so much. I said, well, let the daughters name her. And actually, they named her Dove at Dawn. Another good story this year: the one that had claimed at Keeneland for 40 off of me, she was a California bred. They named her Back on Track, and I paid $1,500 for her at Phasic Tipton. She won for maiden 25 at Indiana. We ran her back for 40, never win two, and they claimed her for 40, and she ran third. And so that was, like, spectacular for both Conception and I.
Yep.
You know? So.
Yeah.
Yep.
Do you ever see a day where you have so many horses that you say, all right, I'm going to step away from the dentistry side of things to focus on training horses full-time?
Absolutely not, because I've been there. You know, I tried that, and I know how hard it is. And doing dentistry, you know, it's routine, it's scheduled. We both have lives. Like, it was great for raising our kids and having a life. And I know it's a rewarding life, but it's a tough life, you know, that racetrack and the ups and downs. And I love having that stability that I have and taking shots that I can afford to take, and just enjoying the success that way.
Yeah. So the plan going forward would be to keep a small string of horses and keep dabbling on the training side, but the dentistry is always going to be the focus.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I do the top, you know, all the top people in the industry. I actually do the horses at Disney World.
Really?
I do the horse at Disney World, which that was just a good gig for some conversation piece, you know. I also do Spendthrift and Into Mischief, that's worth who knows how much. But I said, everybody knows Disney. Like, any stranger that you come up on the street, you tell me do horse dental work on a horse at Disney, and it's always, you know, a good conversation piece.
And I
do Bill Gates's daughters. I've done those and stuff. So, like I said, it took on a life of its own outside of what we do, you know, on the farm and at the track.
That's cool. That's really neat. Yeah. It's amazing where this business and this industry can take you. And, you know, the love of the horse is always the core and the central part of it. But, you know, there's so many people outside of racing that own horses in other disciplines. And it kind of weaves its way through. And it's pretty incredible. John Jezeski with me here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. John, we hear about the legs of a horse being so important and the hoof being so important, but people don't often think about the teeth being an integral part of a horse's health. How important is it?
You know, it's a very, you know, it's out of sight, out of mind. People don't see what I see. So it's very neglected area in our industry and in horse business overall, because I've seen things, you know, that you would not expect. I mean, you know, grade one winners with mouths that look like a torture device, you know, coming out. And so I wish people would educate themselves a little more on what needs to be done and why you do it, because it is huge. And that's when I started doing so many yearlings. Those pinhookers and stuff, that there's no stone unturned. The details are important to them, and they realize these yearlings need it done early, you know, to prep well. And the same thing with them, you know, when they're 2 and 3 and they're losing caps and everything. I mean, their mouth needs to be balanced and everything needs to be, you know, good. So it's a very important aspect that probably should be paid more attention to detail in that area.
I despise going to the dentist. Never have liked it one time in my entire life. And I'm very proud to say I'm sitting here at 52 years old. I've never had a cavity, by the way. But I despise going to the dentist. Do you have horses that are good patients and horses that are bad patients, just like people?
Oh, no doubt. No doubt. I mean, there's where you just become a really good horseman, because you have to be. You can't. I mean, and they don't like restraint. Restraint is not a thing. And a lot of people, they don't want to sedate everything. When I'm doing 120 broodmares at a farm, they want to sedate every broodmare. So you learn to get along with them, and you learn, in a way, I'm only working with them for 20 minutes. I know what they're going to do, and they don't, almost. They don't know how to react. I know, you know, they all kind of react the same way, so I kind of know what to do to counter their reactions. And you just learn that over time, and it just becomes second nature to you, and therefore it allows you to do the work you need to be doing and get it done.
That's a great profession, and it's been a wonderful career for John Jezeski. He's hoping to add to that career and make it even better with a win in the Kentucky Jockey Club coming up on Saturday. John, we're down to the final 4 minutes or so in the program, and I always wrap up this show by asking trainers to tell me something about them that we haven't talked about yet. So something outside of racing. Are there other hobbies or interests or things that you enjoy when you do get a little bit of free time?
You know, I'm kind of like a lot of people in our industry. I kind of live and die I mean, I love every sport that exists. I played every sport that I could, you know. So I'm a sports guy, but I kind of live and die that. Of course, my family, I enjoy messing with them. I enjoy like acting like I'm doing it half-assed and still being successful, I guess, is part of my fun, you know. And that's about it. I mean, like I said, that's the only things we got going is what we do here on the farm and at the track and with our family. So I enjoy every part of it.
What's your favorite sport?
Playing. I love basketball just because I was best at wrestling. Love playing basketball. I would say watching. I would be a football fan. I think, aren't you a Steelers fan?
I am.
Yes. Of course, I'm a Packers fan. It's you know, growing up in Wisconsin, you live and die Packers.
Right.
Yeah. So I would say football. Both my wife and I, footballs. You know, we go to the UK games. We have season tickets to their games, and that would be my favorite sport to watch. Yeah.
Was basketball your best sport to play?
Well, I said, like wrestling, I went undefeated until it made me so nervous I just could keep doing it. I chose riding races instead of wrestling. But basketball was fair. I was fair at, you know, I was fair at. And then there again, handicapping. That's another aspect I guess we didn't get into. But I won $12,000 on the Derby when I spent $200, got $12,000 when Giacomo won. You know,
wow.
And I went to Vegas for the handicapper contest there. So I don't do it much. It's not like I'm a handicapper. I just enjoy doing it. You know, when we have company and stuff.
All right. So handicap the Kentucky Jockey Club for me on Saturday.
Well, obviously, Aspison's horse. You know, they paid $500,000 for him. He runs first and comes back second in the race at Keeneland.
Yeah.
He'll be tough to beat. There's some speed. So, you know, like I said, we don't need to go to the front. So I would, you know, I think anybody that lays off it and close so they don't get away from them will have the best opportunity to win.
Look at that. I put him on the spot. Doesn't have the past performances in front of him, and John knocks it out of the park. John, listen, I really appreciate it, man. This has been such a fun visit, and all the best with One Red Scent on Saturday. I hope he sits the perfect trip and can find a way to get you to the winner's circle. Keep it rolling, and all the best, my friend.
All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
All right, so much fun to hear your story. That is John Jezeski. The pronunciation looks nothing like the name is spelled, by the way, if you go back and look him up. One Red Scent going in the Kentucky Jockey Club on Saturday. It's going to be one heck of a horse race. My thanks to John. My thanks to my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio for helping us make this show sound good. And my thanks to all of you for tuning in here to Trainer Talk each and every Wednesday throughout the year. It is Thanksgiving tomorrow, and I am very thankful for all of our listeners and all of our sponsors, including Phasic Tipton, who has been a longtime sponsor of this show. My thanks to Chauncey for handling all of our social media. I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.